We'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting together, to order that is. What are we, the last day of January? And it's 1:33, 1:34. Today, the only thing we have on the schedule today is talking about Senate Bill 64. We laid it out last meeting, tried to go through the sectional, just generally as much as we could in broad terms first, and then down into some of the details. Secondly, obviously a lot of details. So, but there's also questions on how does that work. And what I'd like to do today is I'd like to get at least four people up to testify on the how does that work question. First of all, Department of Corrections, I think, because a lot of what we're dealing with is accountability measures that it's going to be under their direct control. But we also have the Department of Law. We have Annie Carpinetti here, who will maybe talk about how does that work with other laws or in court or some of the issues that you have. And so I'd ask you to go ahead and lay on the table for us to think about things where we might want to look at a different way to make that policy call. Or, you know, so go ahead and we want to work on this bill so that it actually works well. And then I'm going to have Carmen Gutierrez. Sorry for butchering that name. But is she going to be on teleconference? Be on teleconference? Okay. And Carmen is somebody I've leaned on significantly, as many have, is in a different capacity than the first time we met her. I think she was Deputy Director of DOC, Department of Corrections, and has become one of our experts on reentry. Certainly, I think she was the champion for the PACE program. And then we have Kelvin here, who I will introduce as we go in, who else is actually looking at how to do reentry housing and programmatic approach. So we'll time meeting, Kelvin. I will get you up here. But the first thing I want to do is look at kind of how does the statute work with kind of our professional group. And for those who are calling in, my expectation is to let you have testimony. If there's somebody who is just, you know, ordinary private citizen who feels like today's the only day they get to talk, make sure that you get to my staff, let them know so that I can let you put your comments on the record today. So for those listening online, wasn't my intention to start that, but if that's the only time you can do it, we'll do our best to make allowance for that. So what we did was last time we adopted the G version of Senate Bill 64, and so that will be what we'll be working on. And what I'd like to do is have Ron Taylor, Deputy Director of Department of Corrections, come up. Did I get the title right? I'm going off of memory, which is not always a good thing. Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections.
Deputy Commissioner, I knew I had something wrong in there.
And Mr. Chair, there's only a few comments that I'd like to add with respect to G of the draft. And if we would go to page 18, section 29.
Okay. Page 18, section 29 of the version G that we've adopted under Senate Bill 64.
And Mr. Chair, we would like to see as part of the duties of the commissioner under line 10, the end of that sentence where it says been identified as being at high risk for violating their conditions of parole, or I'm sorry, for probation. We'd actually like to see that identified as being moderate to high risk after receiving a risk assessment. We actually want to tie this to the risk assessment tool.
Okay. This is eligibility requirements for probation offenders, right?
Well, this was for the PACE program, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Chair.
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay.
So those moderate to high risk persons who are in need of additional monitoring through PACE, that's who would be appropriate for PACE monitoring.
So the high risk is not inclusive enough is what you're saying.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It's not the high risk isn't defined. It could be subjected to whoever the commissioner is. And here, this ties it to our risk assessment tool.
Okay. So on 10, probably at, and then for just working language, being identified as being at moderate to high risk. Okay, I will take that under suggestion. And as we get into this, I have some of the how does that work questions. So.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
All right, Mr. Chair, on page 20, and this is the new duty, I believe, that was added. The new duty of the commissioner, 7, which is on line 19 through 22. All I wanted to do was just to bring to the attention of we are doing risk assessments, especially on our sentenced felons. Our policy right now is to do risk assessments on sentenced felons that have a term of incarceration of 45 days or more. And right now we've got about 63% of those risk assessments completed on those who are sentenced to 45 days or more. That's not saying that we couldn't comply with this statutory requirement or this requirement. We would certainly be more than happy to do that. I was just informing you because I think last time it was brought up maybe we were at 30 or 40%, if I'm not mistaken. So wanted to make sure.
Help me understand what the percentage of what you've got here. You're saying that you're already doing assessments that take in 60% under this category?
At the moment, we're doing risk assessments on sentenced felons. About 60% of our sentenced felons we have current risk assessments on.
All right.
But it's 45 days. They've been sentenced to 45 days or more versus the 30 days or more.
And so what's the difference between 45 and 30? Why 45 for you? And I'm wondering how we got to 30-day here. There must be some nexus for that. So what's the 45-day value to
that, you? That 45-day was just a policy call in the department.
Arbitrary? Is it?
It was nothing tied to that 45 days for okay. us, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let me, I'll just put 45 with a question mark here. Do a little bit of thinking on that. That's already being done. And so establish a program, you could walk right into that then. So it's already established. It's not localized. It's not, I mean, does this push you out broader?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, for our, to go down to 30 days, that would make it a little bit broader in terms of who we were doing the risk assessments on.
Uh-huh. What would
but it's something that we're already moving toward anyway. So
what would be swept into that category, Ron?
It's a term of incarceration. Right now we're doing 45. If they have 45 days and out, we would do that risk assessment, the long version of the risk assessment mm-hmm. for them. Here it would require for 30 days and out, and that would mean I don't know the number of the persons that would include, but that would expand those that would be eligible for or that would be required to do a risk assessment on.
And okay. And this is, you're talking about sex offenders, so your felons primarily here? Or is it others?
Mr. Chair, this is for everybody. This isn't for sex offenders. Any person that has a term of incarceration over 30 days or more. Right. So it could be misdemeanors or our felons that have that
broad category. Okay.
Yes, sir.
I'm getting used to this as much as anybody else here. I knew what we were asking for, but I have to keep reminding myself where I'm at in this map. So,
Mr. Chair, for the last section that we'd like to just offer some comments on is the Recidivism Reduction Grant Program and Fund.
Which is?
It's right below that. It's Section 31. It's on the same page, 20.
Section 31, got it.
And as you mentioned during the last hearing, the department currently does not do grants, and so what we would need is the infrastructure to be able to manage and administer grants in the department. since this is really not defined yet, we don't know the scope of work that would be required. We don't know the amount of grant funds that we would look at or how many grants that you're contemplating us assigning. It's a little difficult right now to say these are the staff persons and this is the type of infrastructure we'll need. We're speaking with other departments that are actually do grants, getting some guidance from them in terms of giving you a better understanding of what our potential would be. For example, based on 40 grants, here's what we could do. A grant administrator could oversee these many grants. So that's the type of guidance we'd be able to provide to you, but we're currently working on that.
So you need guidance on how to do it. Do we need to give you guidance on what to do?
Yes, sir. You would need to give us some guidance in terms of if you're offering grants, Mr. Chair, how much are each grant's going to be? How many of these grants going to be in there? That has to be defined. If not here, it's got to be defined somewhere in terms of what your intent here is here. And then I would say on the next page for 21, as the draft of the bill is right now, it would require any program that would receive a grant under this section to have all five. Case management services, they would require sober living and total abstinence. They would actually have to provide the residential treatment for substance abuse, require full-time employment, and have a limit on residential placements in the program. Now, for us, in looking at this type of fund, and when we're talking about reentry, it is perhaps an incredible opportunity for us because we know that connecting our guys that are being released to transitional services and reentry services in the community, that's one of our biggest challenges that we reported on in our House Finance Committee meeting the other day. And so for us, building in a little bit more flexibility on, one, going into other communities that will not have the infrastructure to offer a residential treatment program for substance abuse, but they may be able to provide case management, they may be able to provide mental health services, for example, or other reentry programming that's not included here. This list is very restrictive in terms of how those grants would be administered, and you'd really have to have a program that had a large enough infrastructure to be able to offer all these services from day one, and they probably have to be one of our substance abuse providers doing that, not any of our reentry.
How about
services.
Let's step back a couple of paces and say, okay, on reentry programs now that I understand they're voluntary right now, and there are few. What is actually happening now if somebody can get into a post-incarceration program? What are the general requirements now? Are these similar? Are these more rigid? Are they higher bar?
The Mr. Chair, the requirements are close. They are more rigid because what you would require is somebody like Kelvin's program, for example, to actually be a residential treatment program, and he's not a residential treatment program. He provides housing for those guys and ladies that are coming to his reentry center, but he's not a residential treatment program. We have several other reentry centers that will provide stipends for housing. They would provide case management. They will make referrals for substance abuse, for example, referrals for employment. They're not going to provide all of these things that you have restricted here. And there could be other reentry services that really, as we continue down this road, there are a broad array of other services that we should probably allow, especially in some of our rural communities where we know that we're going to have to do a better job of dealing with reentry issues in areas where there's limited resources, limited availability for these types of services. We're going to have to be a little bit more creative in allowing those reentry services.
So if I was going to go from prescriptive like this is to an outcome, what would I describe as an outcome for a grant requirement under this condition? And I don't know that you have to answer it right now, but maybe that's a better question for us, is to have a statutory requirement for outcomes that can be measured and hold them accountable for those. Is that something that you've thought about in DOC and other programs?
Mr. Chair, certainly something that we would be willing to work with you. I know that we've been working with your Safford Jordan on this, and we would certainly be willing to look at a list of things that services, reentry services that other states that are doing a great job in this area can provide, and having some flexibility in terms of combination of services that we've got to provide. Because as a grantee, being able to deliver these services, they may not be able to do all of this all under one roof. They may have to partner with or collaborate with another agency to be able to provide that. Right now, that one grant is going to that agency, and they'll be required to do all of these services. And so we're just suggesting that you build in more flexibility and broaden this to allow more reentry services and programming available.
And one of the themes that probably will run through this is not only how do we do that, but how do we measure while we do that? And so it's we're looking for an outcome, and that's why I'm saying maybe rather than being prescriptive. For example, I know right off the bat when I was reading this, the full-time employment. What about part-time employment? Is that better than no employment? You know, so
or education for that matter. Yeah.
So. That's why I got to thinking maybe we need to get to the outcome, and I don't know how to describe that yet, but for those committee members, if you have suggestions, so I've got that noted as something we'll work on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's all the comments I had. I'm available for questions.
I know, Ron, during the interim, when we were doing nothing but just going to work. No, we actually had a couple of meetings that you came to, and we were trying to get in front of us what programs were working. And I know that we've done some 24/7 programs around Alaska. How is your interaction with them as a corrections? Is it something that you're closely working with, or is it something that has happening distant to you? What's the connection? Help us understand the how do you do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the past, we were working with 24/7 in the areas that they had it, like Anchorage, for example. And when that program discontinued, we were without a service. I know that right now the Department of Health and Social Services has been working on a pilot program for 24/7 in Anchorage and Fairbanks area that we are working actively with them to get established. And our violators, our high violators, those that have alcohol issues that continue to come back before the court or the parole board would be those that we would be making recommendations to the court or the board to actually be involved in 24/7. So I see where we would have a pretty good role in referring those guys that we've had some difficulties rather than sending them back to jail, to give them another option to help them remain sober while they're on probation and parole.
So for you, was there a noticeable, and I'm sorry for dominating the time, committee members, so just chime in if you need. But for me, I need to understand, we had the 24/7 program in operation. It dissipated, I take it, and went to a pilot program. And what was the notice to you on either reentry or reincarceration? Do you have any way of quantifying that?
No, Mr. Chair. With that one, I wasn't directly involved in that part of the program. I just heard of the results of that, how it was an option for our probation officers to make referrals to that program. And if it was done the way that North Dakota and the other states have done that, it's proven to be something that is an effective way of helping people stay sober while they are on probation and parole or being monitored during that time period. Yeah. So it certainly is an option for our probation officers to be able to use to help people stay successful while they're on probation.
Yeah, I think Carmen Gutierrez is going to probably give us a little bit better understanding of, okay, you know, how it works somewhere else and how it could work here better than it's worked. So I guess I'm open to suggestion, and maybe this is for the Department of Law or even my own, and maybe I see Jeff Jesse here, on how a grant program could be focused on an outcome under this condition that can be measured. And maybe that's a better way than being prescriptive. My first thought was, you know, if you're going to have a grant program, you want to be able to have requirements that are clear. But these are so rigid, it looks like, that we're not going to be able to make it work, because I can see where if you're in a housing first program, for example, this is not going to work.
Absolutely, Mr.
Chair.
And
so there's maybe there's things we have to look at in there.
Thank you, sir.
Any questions from the committee on this?
Thank you, Mr.
That's too easy. There's we're trying to make sure that recidivism has a downturn, but public safety has an upturn. So that's the plan here. So as we go through this, you're going to hear us talk about things in legal terms. If you feel like as we're going along, it just practically, you may be saying it right, but it's not going to work that way. I need to hear from you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Taylor. Deputy Commissioner, to correct myself from earlier. And thank you. And I had a pretty good working session with the Department of Law yesterday on some questions, and I asked them not just to have them become the only questions in my office, but to have them come before the committee. And I really, my intention is to let people see the thought process that goes into trying to figure some of these things out. Not that I want to take waste time, but I want the deliberation to be very purposeful. So Annie Carpinetti was in my office yesterday, and we were going through the bill, and I think, Annie, if you'll come forward, what I'd like to do is probably do like we did earlier, and that is just from the top of the bill down. And if you wouldn't mind just walking us through some of the areas that you have some concern with, some of the things that maybe could be improved, some of the things that maybe have a hard time working together, you know. So I greatly appreciate it. Put yourself on the record, and thank you.
Thank you. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. First, I want to say that we really appreciate the cooperative approach to this bill. And I also want to say that I will be saying some things that are pretty minor details, and I hope I don't sound nitpicky, but and I know that Title 29 is very difficult to draft, and I've done it myself because I've had to, and it's really hard. So I don't want to sound like I'm being critical of the draft at all, because it's a tough job. For sections 1 through 15, and these are the sections that raise the thresholds for theft. I just have two comments to make, and they are these. One, we think it's important that the legislature register its intent on how to, first of all, when this change will take place in terms of who gets charged with the higher crime and who gets charged with the lower crime, whether you want it to be on the date of the effective date of the bill, whether there are decisions out there that that say that whoever is sentenced after the effective date gets to take advantage of the lower sentence, despite when the offense occurred. So it's important that it be stated in the bill.
And maybe you could just take us right to page 2, line 14, where we have the preceding 5-year question, right?
Right.
That was the first place I saw it.
Right. Well, the next one would be, our next comment would be, several places in our theft law say that, for example, it's a Class B misdemeanor. It's a Class B felony for second degree theft if you steal something. Right now, it's over $500. A C felony. I'm sorry, but it's also a C felony if you steal something worth. Right now, it's $50, and you have two prior convictions for theft within the previous 5 years. So it's also important that somewhere in a legislative intent bill you say that you want these to count, even though the values may be a little different. And that's not hard to do. But
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Thank you. So if someone is convicted today of a crime, theft of property, $750, we pass this, it goes into effect, let's say, June 1, would that impact their sentence? Would there be any sort of retroactive impact to this?
Through the chair, well, that's why we would like you to say what your intent is. I read a couple decisions this morning about it, and the court concluded in that particular case, and that was, let's see, I have it. I can give it to you after the hearing, that a person sentenced after the effective date gets the benefit of the new law, even if he or she committed the crime before the effective date.
And maybe I wasn't clear enough, but I'm referring to people who are sentenced before the effective date. So in other words, someone sentenced 2 months ago, and they get the mandatory, which is, I guess, a couple of years, right?
No, generally, through the chair, there's not a mandatory sentence for theft for most
of
this. Class there's
C,
a range.
Right,
there's a range.
The mandatory on the range would be, what, 5 years?
No, for a first Class C, it's 0 to 3, I think.
0 to 3. Okay, so 3 years. Let's say someone got 3 years. We pass, and they just got that sentence a couple months ago. We pass this, and all of a sudden now we make it a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. Someone's sitting in jail for, had this bill been in effect a few months ago, would have been a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
But they're sitting in jail for 3 years. So I guess what I'm asking is this retroactive in any way to the people who are sitting in jail as of the date we pass this?
Well, the point is, I think you ought to make it clear what you intend in terms of retroactive. In that example, I think the court would find that the person should be sentenced under the previous law. But the decision also talked about judges being lenient, understanding that this law is about to change and the difficult position that the judge is in and the defendant is in. But it would be really nice if it would avoid a lot of problems if you would say what you meant.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. I don't want to divert the conversation, but Senator Wilikowski, a defense attorney, recently has communicated with us, and he made the argument on the sentencing hearing that if indeed the sentencing commission that was in place here, you know, what, 10, 12 years ago, had been in place and done their job, we wouldn't have what he characterized as very disproportionate sentencing, and that his client was badly served by the state not following its clear intention before. I thought it was fascinating, and I think the issue is very valid. I don't know how to solve it, and this bill doesn't. Darn it.
So, Annie, a question for me on just a principle of law.
Mm-hmm.
Principle of law would be they would be tried under the old law.
Mm-hmm.
Until a new law is passed, and if the crime was before it, it would still be under the older law. That's a basic principle. You wouldn't necessarily go back retroactive on those things. Right?
Generally not, but in this particular decision, the Court of Appeals took the approach that if you committed your crime before the new law took effect, but you were sentenced afterwards, you got the benefit of the
So, for example, if we passed the law and it was and it had been signed but not effect yet, then there would be good reason to think they could go under that new law.
If it was effective.
So that's one intent that we might want to put in place. And then the other thing is, if you're sentenced under the law now and we change it, and the look-back provisions or the five-year provisions on further thefts,
mm-hmm.
so then would we have to write a letter of stating that is our intention that they would be it would be added under the new law? Or would we have to make it our intent that it would be what they started under the old law, they finished under the old law?
I think if I understand your question, I think you would want to clarify. And I think it's pretty clear as it's drafted now that numbers 1 and number 2 stay the same, even though in this you're reducing the threshold for the third offense.
Mm-hmm. All right, so I'll come up with something drafted, and then I'll let you examine it. But I think I know what we're looking for now.
Okay, thank you. So that takes us to Section 16, and these are bail conditions. And one thing I noticed, and I was speaking to Nancy Mead of the court system, and she noticed it too. for bail conditions on page 9, for example, but this also applies to probation conditions, it gives the court, the judge, the authority to require the person to comply with the 24/7 program. And the 24/7, which is found, I think, on page 18 now.
It's,
yes, on page 18, line 27, that requires the Commissioner of Corrections to set standards of eligibility. So in terms of how this works, we might want to think about how, if the judge is ordering it, does he or she know what the eligibility requirements are and whether this person meets those eligibility requirements or not?
Do you think, Annie, do you, that would be spelled out under 18, or is pointing to 0502G enough?
I think we ought to think about how we should say it so that a judge isn't ordering a person to participate in 24/7, even though he or she doesn't meet the eligibility requirements.
Right. So just for the committee's reference, that will be brought up probably three other times that we point
yes.
to that particular statute. So you might want to make sure that it that's section 20, if I remember correctly, right?
It's well, it's on it's for the bail, it's on page 9 for well, bail is on in several sections here, pages 9, 10,
it's on page 18
and 11.
The program though is on
program,
page 18.
Yes.
And that is I think what I want to do for all those so that we don't get confused, it always points to the program under, I want to make sure I get this right. On page 18, which is 020G,
which is the
at the bottom of page 18, right?
Yeah, and that's the 24/7.
That's the establishment of that 24/7 program.
Right.
I'm just saying that because it took me a while to get there myself, even the way it's drafted.
Uh-huh. Right.
All right.
Our next comment is on page 11, and these are the starting on line 17 through 20, and these are the exceptions to, well, the main section deals with when you get credit while participating in a therapeutic program against time, jail time. And we had two comments. I don't know why you would want to remove work required by the treatment program for a person to get credit for going to work. That seems pretty important. And maybe not approved in advance by the court, because I've heard that's caused some problems, but maybe approved in advance by the person in charge of the therapeutic program.
What I understood from the homework my staff had done was that just the time consumption and the difficulty in getting something approved in advance by the court was mm-hmm. kind of the problem. So I agree, and work required by the treatment program certainly is something I think in agreement with Senator Dyson and you on.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and also in regard to the amendment, we would like to see the term rehabilitative purposes a little ratcheted down a little bit, so it's rehabilitation related to the person's needs rather than, you know, though my boss Rick Savadny has a lot of examples about rehabilitation in terms of, you know, dinner and a movie being pretty darn nice for it.
So you think that's ambiguous enough that it could be thought to be recreation for rehabilitation?
Yes.
And as we have people in jail for a specific purpose to be held accountable, uh-huh. you think that what we're doing is relaxing that accountability?
Well, yes, and but, you know, there are good reasons to do that for a person who's going out to work and but in terms of rehabilitative purposes, you might want to make sure that it has to do with the person's particular needs and not necessarily just
to argue a little bit.
Yes.
I'm thinking out loud, which is always dangerous, but wouldn't that they're expressly limited to time and purpose, wouldn't that be boundaries enough?
Well, that's dinner and a movie. Going out at 6 and coming back at midnight, it doesn't say short amounts of time. It just says specific times, and that's what we're concerned about.
So we need a better directive
mm-hmm.
With rehabilitative.
Yes.
And so what
that
was
would be our suggestion.
And you suggested a tighter word than or another adjective to rehabilitative?
Well, I would like to be able to just draft it and submit it to you.
Okay, I'm gonna,
but that's a concern that we have. And see if you like what we suggest.
And just to be fair to the committee, this is where somebody has been sentenced. They are under Department of Corrections jail time, under sentence, right?
Yes.
And now we're letting them take a little bit of time for really what was expected here as a residential rehabilitation, right?
Right.
That's allowing them to get the same time for being in jail, same credit for being in jail.
Yes.
And I think the concern, as I understand, as the non-lawyer here, is that it really needs to be for rehabilitation for that incarcerated purpose.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. All right. Got it. I got it. I think I got it.
Okay. And there's, on page 12, there's another reference to 3305.020G, which is similar to the other comments that we've made.
I'm sorry, say that again.
On page 12, lines 16 and 17, there's also a cross-reference to the
24/7 3305.
I had a long conversation this morning with people at DMV, and I think they are probably better able to explain concerns that we have with the license revocation, but I'll just hit on some of the high points. First of all, it seems important that somewhere in the bill you recognize the fact that the termination of revocations that you're addressing in this bill deal with termination of revocations for drunk driving and refusal. And there are a lot of other ways that a person can lose their driver's license. You know, if they're a bad driver and they lose their license on under the point system. And actually in Title 28, 2890.010 allows a court to suspend or revoke a person's driver's license for any misdemeanor covered in Title 28. So somewhere you should note that these termination of revocations are only for those and not necessarily for another termination of a license that revocation of a license that might have nothing to do with alcohol problems or you know, things that they're dealt with in therapeutic courts.
Senator Dyson has a question on that one.
Yeah, it's a very related issue we've been talking about. So somebody's in the process of getting, you know, being rehabilitated, mm-hmm. and they get busted for driving without a license. Mm-hmm. No other thing wrong, but in fact they're driving to their drug testing appointment or driving to their job. Mm-hmm. You know, and under existing law, that would cause them to, I think, I have to go 10 years before they can even get back on track to get started on a license again.
Well, I know that there's a pretty significant penalty for driving on a revoked license, 10 days in jail for the second offense.
Sure, but in this case, if you're out on probation parole, mm-hmm. you know, the axe falls.
Right.
And here they've done no evil except to obey an arbitrary decision, and they've not hurt anybody or anything else, and in fact they're maybe trying to comply.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, well, that's why it's really important to say what you intend here.
Yep.
When you are talking about, especially in the administrative return of licenses, because that's mandatory. It requires the department to return a license, and it doesn't have any discretion in terms of the department exercising any decision whether or not to do it.
Yep.
Just requires it in this bill.
Yep.
I think one of the questions that I asked and you brought up as we were talking yesterday on this very issue is if there's a revocation in another area and a permission in this area, we might actually have people go break the law, DOI, so they could somehow fall into this statutory provision to get their license under this condition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we want to do that. I don't know we want to draw people into bad behavior. So
well, I completely agree. And, you know, I have not done this, but I know that you lose, I think, a license if you don't pay child support under certain circumstances. We haven't gone through and looked at whether or not we want to give a license back under this bill. The next thing under on the provision that allows the court to, and this is discretionary on the part of the court, to terminate a revocation if a person has completed the therapeutic court and has been, one of the conditions is that the person has been granted a limited license and has driven successfully under that limited license. One of the previous drafts had a time limit, at least a, I think it was 5 years then, of driving successfully under a limited license. That may not be the right amount of time, but it seems to me like you would want to have some track record of a person driving under the limited license before you gave him or her back his license.
And I agree. And by the way, this I put in there for discussion because I don't know that we can ever get there without some measure of accountability. Because there are some, and the way I always put it is that if I was the one who had to bury my wife because somebody hit them as a drunk driver, would I ever want them to get this? Mm-hmm. And I try to put myself in those shoes as much as I can to say, okay, under what condition? Mm-hmm. And the driving is not the problem. It's the dangerous driving that's mm-hmm. the problem. So I think that accountability measure is something important. So, you know, for the committee members, I'm not interested in trying to open the door to bad behavior. I'm trying to figure out ways to let people be productive while all the rest of us are safe. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Can you help me understand this, what we're doing here, a little bit better? I pulled the statute itself so I can look at it. The 2815-181 says you can revoke a driver's license, and then it lists a series of things,
mm-hmm.
Manslaughter, perjury, operating under DUI, et cetera, et cetera. And then if you go to F says F is how you get your license back. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's the one that's been amended in Section 23 of the bill.
And right now, pretty much the only time you get your license back under current law is if you serve the minimum period of time.
That's correct.
And we're changing that to say, okay, you can get your driver's license suspended for a DUI or whatever, but we're adding one provision that says you can also get it back if you go through these three steps. Is that?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And so do you have a concern with what we're doing here? Explain to me your concern, or if you support it or don't support it.
My only concern is that it one of the three things you have to do to get your license back is you have to have been given a limited license and driven successfully under that limited license. Right now there's no time limit on, I mean, you could have gotten a limited license for a week or a month and then come back to the court and say, now I'm ready for my regular license. And it seems to me that some track record in terms of driving on the limited license would be a wise thing to do. And one of the former versions of the bill had 5 years. That may be too long. But this doesn't have any, and we would suggest that you consider some period.
And if I could, because yes. I'm still trying to understand this provision, Mr. Chair. I mean, policy-wise, do you think this is a good policy? Does the administration think this is a good policy? And I guess I'm envisioning the scenario, and I know people have come to me, constituents have come to me and said, hey, made mistakes. I lost my license for 10 years. Mm-hmm. I can't drive. I can't go visit my family. I can't do anything. I mean, that's sort of the scenario we're driving for, to try to get those people rehabbed and get them back. Is that a policy that the administration supports?
Through the chair, we have no problem with this policy, and we think that there are two sides to it. This will encourage people to get treatment, and that is really important. And a lot of people can't live without a driver's license. They don't live in a city. They have to have one to go to work. So this is something that we are, you know, working with. And
Senator Wilkowski.
And so, which brings me to my last question, because like Senator Coghill, I mean, he's absolutely right. And the fear that we all have is you're going to let that one person go who's going to go out and commit a horrific crime.
Right.
Drunk drive, smash into a family, kill someone. And so would we be better off having something in here or tying this to maybe the 24/7 program and saying, you know what, if we're going to let you out on this, for the remainder of time in which you would have had to not been able to drive, we're going to say you have to go twice a day, or blow, you get a breathalyzer in your home and blow twice a day so that you can prove you're not, you're sober. I mean, is there some sort of tie in there, or is that something we need to add?
Through the chair, the limited license provision, which is in the next section, I think does that. It requires you to participate in what I think is a 24/7, but that's something I think needs to be clarified. So, which is why I think it's important that a person who is driving under a limited license have to do so and comply with the program for enough time to be able to, for a judge to be able to say, yeah, I think you're not going to go out and, you know, run into a family or hurt somebody.
Could, Mr. Chair, just, so are we, is it tied right now? Because that seems to me like something logical. The law says you lose your license for 5 years. We're going to take your license away for 5 years, but maybe after 3 years or maybe after a certain period of time, you've gone through these steps, we're going to let you drive those last 2 years, but you're still going to have to go through the 24/7 program. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be a safe way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it tied? And I'm not seeing how that's tied, and maybe it is. Maybe I'm just off, but that's the way in my head it seems logical to do it.
Through the chair, it's not specifically tied into the court termination of a revocation, but it is specifically tied in, I think, and that's a question I had, but I'm pretty sure it is tied into your ability to get a limited license, and that's under paragraph G on the same page where we start, and these are the standards for getting a limited license if you've been convicted of drunk driving or refusal. And one of them is to be participating in a court-ordered treatment program, but if you go over to the next page on page 14, paragraph 9 on line 30, it says the person participates in and pays the cost of testing as ordered by the court. I think that means participates in the 24/7 program, but that's a question I was going to ask.
And the revocation section of this under F on page 13, that is not necessarily a DUI, or I guess probably that's what I'm going to have to do is, for my own benefit, I guess I have to go back and search 28, 35028, and 35030 and 32. Okay. And so that must be also charged. I'm going to have to go back and make sure I understand that myself again. I thought I understood this before, but I think the same questions arise. How do we keep people accountable under this kind of a limitation?
Mm-hmm.
But I think I know my staff gave me a note, said that Nancy Mead can talk about the 5-year requirement. And Nancy, if you want to come just speak to that, since the issue is on the table right now, if you don't mind having her join you, Annie?
Not at all.
All right.
Like a sidekick.
Thank you, and I appreciate you all working on this, and we're looking for good answers, so please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Just preliminarily, I might be able to clarify on page 13, lines 5 and 6, when the court can terminate a revocation for the offense, A5 is DUI, and A8 is refusal, so that subsection F is limited to DUI and refusals.
Okay,
I believe.
Thank you. I thought that was the case, but it's a lot of detail for this old brain.
With respect to the 5-year time limit, well, it helps me to look at Section 24 is really the guts of the limited license. People under Section 24 have to be in a therapeutic court program. Therapeutic court programs, as the committee knows, last a minimum of 18 months by statute, and sometimes they go up to 24 months depending on the individual and the treatment involved. So the person is in a therapeutic court working with therapists, attorneys, and the judge actively with a lot of meetings for 18 months to 2 years. So Section 24 says, well, you're in that situation, and along with all the other requirements that continue on to page 14, you can get this limited license. Presumably somebody's in it for a couple of months doing well, and the attorneys say this is a candidate for a limited license. It will help them get to their testing, their 24/7 or whatever is required. So at the end of that 18 months, the person graduates from therapeutic court. At that point, the case is closed. they're no longer working with the judge and they're no longer under the court's jurisdiction. So at that point, the person would not comply or not fit under Section 24 because they are no longer a participant. So the question becomes, do you take away their limited license? But Section 23 says, you know, addresses that. In other words, they've been doing fine under Section 24, but they're not in the program. So Section 23 says, okay, you've completed, this is for graduates of therapeutic courts only, you've completed the program, nothing bad has happened to you under B small 2, and you've had this limited license that was granted, again, under Section 24 of the bill, and have successfully driven. The problem with the time limit was previously in Section 24 and said that the court would have to grant the limited license for a minimum of the 5 years. The court doesn't have jurisdiction over the person for that whole 5 years and can't follow what's going on, but kind of more importantly, judges expressed to me that it would be helpful if they had discretion to grant the limited license for less than 5 years. They want to say, let's start you with a month and see how you're doing. Remember, they're in therapeutic court, so the judge sees them weekly or so. And so the minimum time periods were problematic and would have discouraged judges from using the provision to give limited licenses. Now, again, those time periods were in Section 24. In Section 23, might be something slightly different, and you might have different considerations there. You may want to say that the person had a limited license under basically Section 24 and has successfully driven, but the problem is you can't say, it'll be problematic to put in a minimum time period there because nobody's in charge of the person after they get out of therapeutic courts.
So maybe, Nancy, would it be better to then put language in there that said completed a court-ordered program?
Yes, I think that is already in there. And I can work with your staff on trying to put something in that, and I understand the concern that Senator Wilkowski and the committee has on that. And I can try to come up with some wording that would address what you've expressed.
So then for Annie, the next question is Section 23 open to those beyond the Section 24 people who are in therapeutic court?
Well, the Section 23 provisions that terminate a license that ability to get your license back is dependent upon a person completing the treatment program. And it also is dependent on a person driving successfully with a limited license. So, I think DMV will have some comments on some concerns with getting records back and forth under these circumstances, which Ms. Mead is just...
And quite frankly, I think at least two of us on this committee think that the court system and DMV need to have a little closer relationship on this particular issue anyway. Uh-huh. So... look for ways we can tie that together. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Going back to an issue that Annie raised before with how we treat people from past convictions, I'm wondering if on line, page 13, lines 28, 29, where we say the person is participating in a court-ordered treatment program, I'm wondering if we don't want to sweep in people who've maybe aren't serving a long-term suspension who have already completed a court-ordered treatment program?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, those people aren't covered by this bill. You're right. This would be prospective only. In fact, Section 23 will not come into play for probably a year or two because we don't have any graduates who have gone through the Section 24 limited license program, and we won't for a while. So that's your call, whether you also want to grant limited licenses to people who have previously graduated from therapeutic courts, and it's not covered by the bill now, but that would be a possibility.
I mean, is that a good policy call? It seems like it would be. It seems like you're trying to get people who have been through a program. It seems like if someone just completed it today and this law goes into effect in a few months, then they would be excluded from participating in this program, which seems unfair, but would there be a policy reason not to do that?
through the chair, you know, as long as the court has discretion on whether or not to grant it, I don't see one, but I'd like a chance to, you know,
yeah.
I don't see any else.
Okay.
And we'd have to modify a couple of requirements because at this point they would have had to have successfully driven under that type of a program. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to look at that. Senator Wilkowski.
And then one possible suggestion on for Section 23, Mr. Chair, and that is it seems like we're setting up the program so that just to give a hypothetical, someone's convicted of a DUI, they go through this program, they have a long-term suspension, they complete the program, they drive with a limited license, haven't been charged or convicted, and then they're able to get their full license back. And I'm just wondering if the better policy is to say, instead of giving you a full license back, we'll give you a full license back, but you have to have an ignition interlock for the period of time for which you would have your license would have been revoked. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that's a policy call. I get that. I'm just curious to hear if you have any thoughts on that.
Through the chair, well, this most recent draft of this bill adds the requirement of an ignition interlock device for a limited license.
Right, for a limited license, but only during the period of time when you have the limited license.
Yes. I don't have any concern about getting about adding that requirement to. I don't have any policy concern.
And I'll leave that with you to kind of bring to home, do the homework.
I'm just throwing it out, Mr. Chair, just a suggestion. I don't know if it's a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just throwing it out for discussion.
Through the chair, if I could just mention, the court has no position on that, but I would say that
Nancy Mead.
Sorry.
For those typing.
Nancy Mead with the Alaska court system. But these provisions are largely geared towards felony DUI defendants because the misdemeanor DUI defendants, we have therapeutic courts for them. They're not at capacity, and there are very few folks in the state who participate in the misdemeanor DUI courts. So these are mostly for felons. Felons lose their license for DUI for life, and so you would, of course, be mindful that you'd be saying that they have to have an ignition interlock device for life if that's how you do it.
And actually, it might be helpful for me at least to understand what are the lengths of time that people lose their licenses for and for what offenses?
Well, I've got Title 20 years. For felony DUI, drunk driving and refusal, you lose it for life, but after 10 years you can come back and request it be returned to you. I'll have to look up do you mean... And a felony drunk driving is, or refusal is, you know, the third time within a period of, I think the look back now is 10 years.
Yeah.
Do
you want the ones for misdemeanors as well, through the chair?
I want to know what I'm getting into. I want to know.
Okay. A first-time DUI defendant loses their license for 90 days. A second-time DUI defendant loses it for 1 year. Third time is usually a felon, unless their priors were before 10 years before that conviction. And the felons for DUI or refusal lose their license for life.
So third time.
Third time.
Third time.
Within 10 years.
Within 10 years.
Lose it for life.
But there is that ability after 10 years to come back and ask the court.
And one of my intentions was to get them under the 24/7 program as early as we possibly can, so that we don't end up with a felon situation. That's at the front end, but we do have these who have lost their license for a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And that's another question that I keep trying to figure out. What can we do to let them be accountable, productive, but not violate the public safety that we are so dear and really the victims who have been hurt?
And if I could, Mr. Chair, so this section 23-24 is aimed mostly for the three-time offenders. Is that fair to say?
Through the chairs, I don't know if it's aimed to them, because this talks about all people who are convicted of drunk driving and refusal, and then there are provisions in the bill that directly addresses felony drunk driving later on in the bill. So But the reality is that most people convicted of a misdemeanor don't participate in therapeutic court.
Because it's timelines and everything like that.
And I would just add, sorry, through the chair.
Just identify yourself so that...
Nancy Mead for the court system again, through the chair. Senator Wilikowski, 2815-201, to which this bill would add a subsection G, already has a subsection D, which is a mechanism through which misdemeanant DUIs can get their license back. It's a whole separate thing for misdemeanor. So there is a system for that existing.
And I would just add, Mr. Chair, in closing here, I don't want to dominate the discussion, but I mean, if a person's been convicted and this is their third time and they've lost their license for life, I don't, if we make as a policy call the decision to give them an opportunity to drive again, I think we want to do that under the most stringent possible circumstances. And so I don't know that I would think that an ignition interlock for the 10 years or longer is not unreasonable, probably. I mean, the ignition interlocks proved to be very successful, is my understanding.
They are.
So anyway, just while we're talking policy, that's sort of my thoughts on it.
I'm very, very sensitive to that. Just for what it's worth, we're at probably a pretty good place. I've got Carmen Gutierrez that has about 15 minutes worth. And probably ending at the license is probably not a bad deal because the next conversation is 24/7. And I'd really like to let Carmen have, a little bit of elbow room on time. If you don't mind,
we'll
stop at that section 23 and 24, if that's okay with you, Department of Law.
We'll
and
come back.
Court.
Thank you
very much for coming before us. And Carmen, can you hear us online all right?
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Cogswell. Can you hear me okay?
Very well, thank you. Just put yourself on record, and we're here ready to learn from you.
Good afternoon, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Carmen Gutierrez. I have been an attorney for about 27 years, practicing mostly in criminal law. And then from June of 2009 through December of 2012, I had the privilege of working with the Alaska Department of Corrections, first as the Commissioner's Special Assistant, and then as his Deputy Commissioner responsible for prisoner rehabilitation and prisoner reentry. Today I'm testifying in my capacity as a concerned lifelong Alaskan. I would very much like to thank Chairman Coghill, his staff, and the many others who have worked so tirelessly to put this piece of important legislation together. Before I comment specifically on Sobriety 24/7 and on the PACE program, I'd like to just provide a couple of opening comments, if I may.
Sure.
Everyone on this committee knows if the state continues to adhere to some of the ineffective policies of the past, we may very well continue to reap the proven poor results of today and into the future. The failures produced by some of our current approaches often mean homelessness, unemployment, returning to or falling back into addiction. Without appropriate strategies to address these barriers to successful prisoner reentry, there is unfortunately a new crime, a new victim, and ultimately costly reincarceration. As we all know, this is a huge waste of public resources, human resource, and diminished public goodwill. But the good news is that there are now many new evidence-based approaches that have been proven, as seen by the results now in other states, to reduce recidivism, cut crime, and slow the rate of prison population growth. SB 64 seeks to implement some of these new approaches and to establish the Criminal Justice Commission that would continue to work on these important issues. So now I'd like to first direct my comments to Sobriety 24/7. This bill has provisions providing for Sobriety 24/7 in Section 16, which starts on page 8, Section 17, page 9, and Section 20, page 11, and section 29, which is page 18. Sections 16 and 17 modify the statutes providing for pretrial conditions of release. It gives a judge needed authority to order as a condition of pretrial release that an offender participate in a sobriety 24/7 program. Section 20 adds sobriety 24/7 as an additional statutory condition of probation. So if an offender is ordered to felony probation, the court would, under this bill, have the authority to impose the 24/7 program as a condition. And then finally, Section 29 gives the DOC commissioner the duty and authority to establish the 24/7 program and its eligibility requirements. So, Senator Coghill, you asked briefly about the history of 24/7 in Anchorage. We had in Anchorage, with the participation of Chief, with the Anchorage Police Department, the city prosecutor, Cindy Franklin, the Alaska court system, specifically then District Court Judge Easter, and DOC, a pilot project for 24/7. The pilot project was really financed largely by Partners for Progress. They worked tirelessly to get that program implemented. The pilot project was initially for DV offenders. It was expanded to include other kinds of offenders. And my understanding is that even though it was a small pilot project, and it was small because of funding, that it was showing success. Unfortunately, the project did not receive additional funding in last year's fiscal budget, and so it closed doors. But as a result of the effort that was made in getting that program up and started, I think that there was some real ongoing interest in the project, and I know that the presiding judge of the Fairbanks Second Judicial District was very interested in having sobriety 24/7 as a pretrial added condition of release for judges to use. So I just want to make sure that the members of the community understand the distinct differences between sobriety 24/7 and the PACE program. And so if this is a good time, I'd like to talk just briefly about what sobriety 24/7 is.
Yes, ma'am. Please do.
So under the program, and this could be utilized, this program really could be utilized for pretrial offenders. I mean, today, when an individual is been arrested and incarcerated, they seek release on bail. There's many combinations of factors and conditions that may be ordered by a judge. One of the standard conditions of bail release is that a person is released to the 24-hour third-party custody of another individual. I think judges are beginning to see that sobriety 24/7 provides them with another, perhaps more meaningful way of ensuring that a pretrial offender is not using drugs or alcohol. So under sobriety 24/7, pretrial and convicted offenders are monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by a variety of testing methodologies. So this could be the breathalyzer, it could be a SCRAM unit that is utilized to detect alcohol in a person's system. And the goal is to use methodologies that are appropriate for the community in which these programs might be established. And the long-term goal of this approach is to seek positive behavior by people who abuse drug and alcohol, because while they're on the program, they begin to see the benefits that come with extended sobriety. So under the program, an individual is required to go to, if they're using the intoximeter or the breathalyzer approach, they go to a center and they blow into an intoximeter twice a day. For example, it could be at between 7 and 8 a.m. in the morning and between 7 and 8 p.m. in the evening. This would then determine whether or not a person has had ingested any alcohol in the preceding hours. If a SCRAM unit is used, that it has the technology to actually download readings from the unit to determine if a person has ingested any prohibited substance. If the person tests positive, as we had in the Anchorage pilot project, we have a mechanism in place where the authorities and the prosecutor's office are notified immediately, and the individual is apprehended and taken to jail, with the goal being that they are brought to court in a very swift and certain fashion for the imposition of a sanction. And there is software now available that is utilized where it can actually, it relays information about a positive or negative testing directly to the courts and directly to the prosecutors. Of course, that software has a charge. It's not free, but in smaller communities, you probably don't even need that kind of technology. In terms of whether or not sobriety 24/7 has been proven to be successful, because we're looking for successful, proven approaches, I'd like to cite the members of the committee to the RAND Corporation that did a study on 24/7 that was published in the American Journal of Public Health on November 15 of 2012. The RAND Corporation, as I understand it, is a nonprofit that has a long history of performing public policy research and analysis. The study found that the number of individuals who participated in South Dakota's 24/7 program by 2010. It started in 2004, and it was the brainchild of the then South Dakota Attorney General. And so from the RAND Corporation analyzed data from 2005 through 2010. By that point, almost 25,000 individuals had participated in South Dakota's program, and which was a considerable portion of the state's population then, which was 825,000. Between 2005 and 2010, the program participants took approximately 3.7 million breathalyzer tests. The pass rate was high, 99%, and so the research shows that just the mere threat of being tested positive for the use of alcohol deterred people from continuing to ingest. But what was very encouraging about the RAND Corporation's finding was that 24/7 was associated with a 12% reduction in repeat DUI arrests on the county level. So that was found to be very significant.
So, Carmen, just for what it's worth, I passed out the worksheet that you gave me that actually has the link for the RAND Corporation study on it, I think. So.
Yep. Yes, Senator Coghill, it does indeed, and that is just a fact paper that breaks out some of the main points of, number one, how it works, where it's been implemented, and the findings of the RAND study with the link to the entire study itself.
Thank you.
So, are there any other questions regarding sobriety 24/7?
I do, from Senator Wilkowski, and just to keep everybody on track, my intention is to get out of here at 3 o'clock, so for those who I promised testimony, otherwise, there'll be another day. My apologies, but I thought it would be good to have this testimony in front of us, and Senator Wilkowski, you have a question.
You know, Mr. Chair, I can have an offline conversation with Carmen. If we have people here at
Well, I want to let Carmen Gutierrez finish her presentation, which I think probably going to take another 8 minutes. So if you have a question for us, probably a good time.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to clarify something. The DUI recidivism you said was decreased by 12%. As I read this, it looks like it was actually 12%.
I think we're saying the same thing. I may have misspoke. My understanding of the RAND study findings was that there was a 12% reduction in the number of repeat DUI arrests. Did I misspeak from the fact sheet?
I don't know. It just says DUI recidivism 12%. The
okay.
recidivism rate is generally 66% statewide. If it's 12%, that's excellent. If it's declined 12%, that's still in the 60-plus percent range. So I guess there's a big difference there. But we can try to figure that out offline.
My interpretation of the study, and I will get clarification from the folks that actually wrote it because I've been in touch with them, it was an additional 12% reduction. So I hope I haven't confused the issue, but I'll get clarification on that, Senator, and send it to you.
Thank you.
And to the entire committee.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So I'd like to talk about PACE, probation accountability with certain enforcement.
Yes, ma'am.
And how it works and how it differs from sobriety 24/7. PACE is modeled for Hawaii's program called HOPE, and it was started by Stephen Alm, who was a former U.S. attorney for the state of Hawaii, in 2004 after he became a Superior Court judge. He was very, very dissatisfied with the way the state was doing probation because, as has been the case in Alaska, an individual would commit what we call a technical violation. They would fail to show up for a probation officer appointment, or they would fail to show up for a scheduled urinalysis test, or they would test positive for drugs and or alcohol during their UA test. And it could be months before they would be actually arrested, and then it could be another month or more before their case was actually being addressed in a substantive way by a Superior Court judge. What Judge Alm saw was that people respond more positively when there are swift, certain, and proportionate sanctions imposed for the behavior, which is the way most parents raise their children. So what he devised and what we started with the PACE program is a method whereby, and this happened with the cooperation of the Department of Law, with the Department of Administration, Anchorage Police Department, and Court System and Corrections. And what happened was all the team players came together and said, okay, how is it that we can devise a system when an individual doesn't show up for an office appointment, doesn't show up for a UA, or test positive at the probation office, how can we get them to court swiftly and have a sanction imposed in a swift and certain fashion? So following the model devised by Judge Alm, the Department of Corrections will get a, if it's a failure to show up to the office, a bench warrant is issued immediately with the cooperation of local authorities. That bench warrant is served on the probationer very quickly, often within 24 hours. And then more often than not, especially if it's not a weekend, the individual is brought to court and counsel is appointed, the arraignment takes place, bail is set, or a bail has already been set by a magistrate, but the probationer admits to the petition and a sanction is imposed. This happens all in one court hearing, often within 72 hours of the actual infraction. Under probation as usual, that series of events would normally involve three or four court hearings that would be conducted over a period of 3 or 4 months. What has this been proven to be effective? Yes, at least according to a National Institute of Justice-funded evaluation of the HOPE model, it found that HOPE probationers, when compared to a control group after 1 year, were found to be 55% less likely to be arrested for a new crime, 72% less likely to use drugs, and 61% less likely to skip appointments with their probation officer. The program has been so effective in Hawaii. Judge Alm started with about 100 probationers. He's now up to over 1,200 probationers. And it's been the subject of much discussion amongst criminal justice think tank folks. As a result, there are now 4 study sites where the Bureau of Justice is doing further study, and the report showing the efficacy of the program in these other locations should be out shortly, I think within 6 months. But I think it's very significant to also note that in terms of, you know, what proof do we have that this program is effective, is to look at Steve Ose's recent work with the Washington Institute of Public Policy. As many of you committee members are aware, he's testified before your committee on several occasions in the past. His research is highly regarded across the United States in showing cost-benefit analysis for new approaches to address criminality in Washington State and in other states. And what he did through his research, which was just updated in 2012, he showed that PACE has a 90% odds of a positive net compared to present value. So in other words, whatever the program costs to implement, it has a 90% odds of achieving greater goods than good and outcomes than its actual cost. So with regard to the specific language of the PACE provision, I would respectfully ask the committee to consider on page 18 of the bill, specifically lines 20 and 21, that subsection C be deleted. And here's the reason why. When I was explaining how PACE works, the reason why the court and the probation officers, along with Department of Law and defense attorneys, are able to get the hearing resolved or the case disposed of in one hearing is because the issues of whether or not you attended, made it to the probation office for your appointment, be it an office visit or a UA test, or whether or not you tested positive, are normally matters that are beyond evidentiary dispute. They don't require an evidentiary hearing. Many other allegations of violating conditions of probation do require evidentiary hearings, and those matters cannot always be resolved as expeditiously. So I respectfully submit that subparagraph C should be deleted. That does not mean that the probation officer would not file a petition to revoke probation, but it wouldn't follow under the PACE guidelines as set forth in Section 29.
Carmen,
I would also, when I'm not comfortable speaking on behalf of corrections, but based upon my experience, I would suggest the committee consider adding a PACE provision for the parole board. I think it makes, people are on parole often before they're on probation. And if we want people to understand from the get-go, from the moment they're released from prison, that conditions of probation mean exactly what they say, and that the so-called technical conditions will be strictly enforced, that message should be learned when people start on parole, and then hopefully the lesson is well ingrained by the time they're on probation.
Carmen, thank you. What I'm going to ask you...
I don't know if there's 4 minutes. I don't know if, Mr. Chairman, you would like me to talk about Section 19, which modifies the credit for jail time provision.
I'd like it, but I can't do it. what I'm going to do is I'm going to have to go ahead and close the meeting down. You've given...
Senator?
Yes, you've given some pretty good comments. Can you hear me all right, Carmen? We got we're caught in the echo chamber.
I'm sorry, sir. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, but we're getting the echo, so I'm going to have to cut this conversation off, and I'll check in with you later. So why don't you go ahead and cut me off there, and I appreciate that. So just instructions to those. My apologies, Kelvin. I was going to have him come up. We've run out of time. But as you can see, there's a lot of moving parts in this. Jeff Jesse has indicated that he'd like to be a part of the discussion. There are many, many parts to this. The license issue, I wanted to spend as much time because that is to me, that's one of the tougher areas. The reasons why we're doing it probably just got articulated very well, but some of the suggestions on how to implement I think were helpful. So my intention is not to rush through this bill, but I don't want to just drag it out either. Perfection is not going to get in the way of production, so we're going to keep moving forward. I got several committees where we're going to be probably one of the hardest working committees on it, I expect, but there are financial issues, and then we've got the other body that needs to look at it. And I think we're about 78 days left in the session, so I will probably come back on Monday with some suggested changes right off that are high level after we've had another discussion with the Department of Law. Department of Corrections, if you can kind of track us, we're going to have Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for this particular bill. So modifications, suggestions, and we may end up with arguments with you, but we'll look for those policy calls that we can agree on and get this thing moving. So that's generally my schedule at this point, and I will probably bring some suggested modifications that I think are at the big chunk, high level, that can solve some of the maybe the smaller kind of how do we do that legal questions. So anything from the committee on requests or suggestions at this point? Thank you all for being here. My apologies for not getting everybody in. As you can see, this will grow. But I think we've got I think we have a good policy call to make, and I think if we can get this landed in Alaska, we will do good to Alaska. We will probably save money based on some of what we've heard, but the public will be safer, and I think we can get this thing done. So thank you for your attention today. We'll call this Senate Judiciary Committee meeting adjourned.